Jim's invitation, very fitting, right? A time of a famine for the Word. Certainly, the time period we're looking at is a time where there was a famine for the Word. I gave as an assignment, I know not everybody was interested in the assignment, and that's okay. And not everybody would have necessarily had time for the assignment, but if you did, read from the reading I gave you, 1 Maccabees. What was it like? Could you compare it to some Bible books, something that was similar in at least style? Reminded you of Kings. Okay. Anyone have anything different they thought of?
It reminded me of the book of Esther because it didn't mention God.
Okay. That's another good possibility. Kings, Esther. And you sort of, I guess, caught even from just the first chapter, and that was not even quite the entire first chapter. One of the things that's interesting about 1 Maccabees is that God doesn't come up a whole lot. We'll see a big difference when you do the reading for next week. But in 1 Maccabees, what kind of literature is it? I already told you that one in the little paragraph I put at the beginning of it. What would we call it in any other context? It's a book of
history.
Anyone sort of guess about when it was probably written, even just from reading the first paragraph? Yeah, somewhere after the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. He starts, you get through verse 8, and then he starts talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, who lived about 168 B.C., who reigned about 168 B.C., and actually, he jumps like 200 years in 8 verses, and then the rest of the book, he covers about 20 years, which really tells you, okay, he was somewhere right in that time period. He's writing about mostly his recent history, the time of the Maccabees. He doesn't really know a lot about what happened before. He just sums it up in a few words. What we'll look at this evening, we'll see even the few words that he used to sum up those 200 years, he got it wrong. He just sort of glosses over a lot of things and makes it simple. Not quite accurate, but he makes it simple for people to understand what he was saying. And that's the way a lot of times people do about history, right? You're talking about something. How's it different, though, than the book of Kings? Or Esther? What do we know about the book of Kings and Esther as far as its accuracy? It is accurate. Even though people have, at various times, critics have tried to say, oh, it made a mistake here or there. Usually, the critics eventually, sometimes 50, 100 years later, some archaeologist digs something up and says, oh, he was right, we were wrong. That's going to be very different than in Maccabees, where sometimes the errors are kind of glaring. Actually, most historians find Maccabees, first Maccabees, there's 4 of them, and in some cases there's 5 of them, first Maccabees to be fairly good as a history book for its time period, 168 to 150, 140, somewhere in that area. The time he lived in. It's his own history. He's writing about his own days, what's going on, what happened. But like any historian, especially if you're writing from a, think of it like World War II, if you were writing from the American viewpoint, your history book of World War II, it would read kind of different than the German history book of World War II or the Japanese history book of World War II, right? Everybody writes from their own perspective. And the book of Maccabees is written from the perspective of a Jew. And therefore, some of the heroes seem larger than life. Maybe a little more heroic than they probably really were. But that's just kind of natural. You sort of hold up your heroes. You make them do greater things. When we get to 2 Maccabees, he takes it to a whole nother level as far as nationalism goes. But 1 Maccabees is generally considered pretty accurate within some... as a human history goes, because any other history book you read is the same way. What about how we might use it? as Christians? Okay, look, Laurie's saying it helps us fill in some gaps in knowledge. It helps us to understand things that we wouldn't otherwise know. And it actually answers a few questions from periods like in Daniel chapter 8 when he talks about the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. He calls him the vile person in the prophecy in Daniel 8. And again in Daniel 11 he calls him a vile person. So, you know, when you're reading those things and you go and look and see what he did, reading Maccabees, you can understand why he was called a vile person, because he really was. He was kind of cruel and evil and, you know, a degenerate by almost any standards. So it can help us to understand the prophecy, helps us figure out what was going on. And as we'll see when we get to that period, Maccabees actually will help us see where some things in the New Testament started from. Some of those things we talked about last week, some of those names and terms and groups, some of them had their origins in this time period. And the book of Maccabees helps us to at least understand and appreciate where they came from. So that's, you know, as I said last week, we're only going to spend those 5 minutes or something each week talking about what the reading was. Next week will be 2 Maccabees, a little bit different. More nationalistic, more God, more religious. I call it a religious history. I thought about putting history in quotation marks because the history part of it kind of falls by the wayside at various points. There's a lot of falsehoods, a lot of fabrication, a lot of made-up stories, mixed in with some history. You know, so there is some history in 2 Maccabees, but not so much. Most of it's, you know, sort of things your parents or grandparents might have told you. If you were living in that age, you'll see what I mean. I've only got a couple of readings from the first and second chapters. Things that you should be able to recognize, especially the first chapter. He's going to tell you some whoppers about Nehemiah. So you've just studied Nehemiah. So when you read the second reading from chapter 1 and he's telling you some stories about Nehemiah, you should all go, that didn't happen. Even more so when you get to the chapter 2, where he's telling some stories about Jeremiah. He makes up some stories because it makes a good point. He's trying to make some good morals, even if he's telling lies. Okay, we'll get back to our study. We're going to actually look at the Greek period. We're going to look at the time of Alexander. And the reason we're going to look at the time of Alexander, we did a little bit when we did our Daniel class, and I'll remind you why. If you've got your Bible, turn to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. And if somebody would read for us verses 3 through 7. Through 7. Okay, and if you jump down, if you read in the explanation of the vision, verse 20, it says, "The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes, the first king." and it's the first king of Greece. That's important because you might think, well, his father was the first king, and his father was a king, but he was king of Macedon or Macedonia, a very small province on the very northern edge of what we would call Greece. Philip was a tactician. Philip was considered to be a great strategist. Philip was a wise man, and he was trying to raise his son to learn the ideas of the art, what we call, the Chinese call it the art of war, right? He wanted his son to be able to be a good king. In order to do that, he hired Aristotle. Anyone remember Aristotle? What do you normally think about Aristotle from?
Philosophy.
He was a philosopher. I could almost sort of tell where you went to school based on your answer. Somebody had a different answer, I thought. No scientists here? He was a scientist. He wrote the book called Nature. He was a philosopher. He was a natural scientist. He was a student of, who was Aristotle's teacher? Anyone? Oh, missed one in between. Plato. And before Plato, Socrates, right? He's in a very prestigious line of philosophers. And Aristotle, can you imagine, was hired to be Alexander's tutor, to teach him what he knew, starting from the age of 13. Alexander told his dad he didn't want to go to school just on his own. He wanted some friends. So his dad agreed to let Aristotle teach Alexander and his friends. So several boys his own age got to come and to attend a school taught by Aristotle. It's important to know this because these friends became Alexander's friends for life. When he went to war, his friends came with him. His friends he called his companions. And they became his personal bodyguard. They became his heavy cavalry. And when he needed them later and his army got big enough, they became his generals. He started, you know, saying, okay, I trust you because you've been my friend my entire life. I trust you. You go take care of the army over there. That was an important thing for Alexander, this idea of friendship, of companions. One other story I'll tell here quickly about Alexander. This same age, 12, 13, about the time his father said he was old enough to start school, a traveling horse salesman came through. Stories told variously by various historians. But a horse salesman came through and offered a magnificent stallion to Philip for an outrageous sum of money. I can't remember now what it was. It was something like 12 talents of gold. And Philip said, well, it's a beautiful horse, but nobody would be able to ride that horse, and it certainly isn't going to be worth 12 talents if nobody can get on it. And Alexander said, Dad, if I can get on it, will you buy it for me? And he said, sure, son. And Alexander got on and rode the horse, and his dad paid the 12 talents, and that became his horse for life, Bucephalus. He named his horse, and his horse was with him almost to the end. So he was not only a precocious child, he was a good horseman. He was able to tame the stallion that nobody thought could be tamed. Philip tried to unite Greece. It's what he always wanted to do. It didn't really work. Greece was a bunch of city-states. They fought constantly, all the different Greek wars you hear about in school, the Peloponnesian Wars. They really didn't want, Athens didn't want to be aligned with Corinth or with Sparta, and none of them want to be aligned with Macedonia. Eventually, somebody assassinates King Philip. Nobody still knows who. And at age 20, Alexander becomes Alexander the Great, or he would be later. He was Alexander the Third. He was the third Alexander, king of Macedonia. But the first king of Greece. He became king of Greece within 1 year of taking the throne, doing something his father had tried to do for over 20 years and had failed. Alexander resorted to the simple expedient of taking an army and invading each of the neighbors, and as he conquered each neighbor, he brought them into his army. He said, rather than putting them down and crushing them, he conquered them till they surrendered. As soon as they surrendered, he said, okay, join. And he moved on to the next, and the next, and the next, and his army kept getting bigger, and people started saying, hey, this is pretty good. We can all work together. Alexander then said, well, you know, we're done conquering Greece. The next year he decided, well, let's conquer Thessaly. That was the next province north of Greece. The following year he said, hey, let's take it across into Asia, into what we would call Turkey today. And so he actually went across with just 25,000 Macedonians from his own, 7,600 Greeks from the new allies, the people he had conquered, 7,000 Thracians and Illyrians, that would be Thessaly, the area north. He fought the Persians, the first Persian group. We talked about this in our study of Daniel. The first Persian group had 40,000 and 20,000 Greek allies. And they fought at the Granicus River, is near ancient Troy. The Persian commander, the satrap, dies the night before the battle begins, and the Persian army's in disarray. Nobody knows how he died, why he died. People suspect Alexander had him poisoned. Others think it was exactly what God said, that he wasn't going to let the Persians stop Alexander. The passage you read, when the ram comes across, he's going to, you know, move so fast his feet wouldn't touch the ground. And so, you know, the Persian commander dies. The Macedonians win. Alexander's suddenly a hero, and most of the Greeks who are on the other side now come over to his army. It's clear Alexander really is a marvelous general, even though he's only 22 years old at this point. Then he moves up and down the coast there of Greece, Asia Minor. And so around 334 BC, he's conquered that area off to the left there, the yellow area that I sort of blocked out. He's managed to conquer all that now in 2 years. And he's not done. He starts moving across into the Syrian territories, the rest of Turkey, into Syria. Darius, the king at that time of the Persians, tries to hold him off at a mountain pass. Darius had a plan. He was going to hold Alexander at the mountain pass, and he was sending a big section of his army by boat to go around behind Alexander, and then they would catch Alexander between both armies. And he didn't want Alexander to find out, so he didn't tell anyone except the commanding general what the plan was. And the general was going to be the one to command the ships. He was also going to be admiral of the fleet. All right, great plan, very secret. Only the two people knew. And while they were on the sea, on their way to sneak around behind Alexander, the general died. Now there was nobody in charge of the navy. There was nobody in charge of the army. The army didn't know what to do because nobody had told them the plan. And Alexander defeats the small force that was holding the mountain pass. Alexander then turns towards Tyre. He's starting down, if you can picture in your mind, the coastland. Right? Tyre is just north of Israel. What was special about Tyre? It was an island. And God had prophesied that one day, Tyre, which was sitting off the coast, a quarter mile off the coast, one day it would be left in ruins and nobody would be there except fishermen casting their nets. Nebuchadnezzar tried to take Tyre. He spent 13 years, not him personally, he left an army, waiting to besiege Tyre. There was a little town on the coast and then the big town on the island. How do you think that turned out, trying to besiege an island from the coast? I think that's probably what Tyre did too. Somebody was laughing over there. You know, like, oh, so there's an army over there. We got boats, right? Tyre was part of which empire? Phoenicia, right? They were the people who settled Carthage, and they were some of the early settlers of Spain. They found some of the islands off the coast in the Atlantic. You know, they were sailors, so it didn't really matter that Nebuchadnezzar sat there for 13 years trying to besiege them. Alexander solved the problem in 7 months. We all know how he did it, which was he tore down that little coastal city and cast all the stones into the water and then walked across on his own little bridge. It was still a very hard battle when he got across, because Tyre did have walls because they didn't want enemy ships to get to them. But within 7 months, he had conquered the city. Then he turned south further. He went to Gaza. Everybody know Gaza, right? It's still in the news. It's still a city in existence. All right, it was, now it's part of the Palestinian territory, right? It's on between Israel and Egypt. It had a big, huge wall at that time. It was a fortress the Persians had put there to station a garrison in case Egypt rebelled. They could, you know, have a little army there that could immediately go in, you know, get them back under control. Alexander only spent 2 months taking Gaza. He wasn't out on an island. He then went on down into Egypt, and Egypt promptly surrendered. And so he didn't take any time at all to conquer the entire nation of Egypt. They surrendered, and Alexander thought, well, if I'm going to leave Egypt, I need to leave somebody in charge. So he picked one of his companions and said, you're now in charge of Egypt. Alexander also, some Jews had joined him when he came down through this area, when he got to Jerusalem. The population of Jerusalem had surrendered as well. They weren't like Gaza. They had surrendered to Alexander. They joined forces. They brought out their army, what little there was. They fought for Alexander. And as a reward, Alexander said any of them who wanted to be in his new city of Alexandria, he gave a quarter of the city to the Jews. It became the Jewish quarter. Right? He gave them a quarter of the city. He said, you guys can have this spot. This could be yours. And the Jews really liked that. Here's a king who really understood them, that they wanted to be, you know, sort of by themselves. So you can see he's conquered now all the way across Turkey, all the way down through Egypt, the land of... He went back to Tyre, he reorganized his army, because he still had to fight the Persians. He hadn't finished defeating the Persians. He fought several more battles. He eventually causes Darius III to flee, chases him 500 miles in 12 days. That was by horses, obviously. Darius actually gets assassinated by his own general, or satrap, Bessus, who is actually a cousin. When Darius was captured by his own cousin, when they thought Alexander was catching up, they actually murdered him. They threw their javelins into the cart in order to kill Darius. Some people say Alexander found Darius still alive. Others said he was dead. Those who say he was alive, Alexander certainly put out the rumor that he was alive. Alexander said he found Darius, you know, murdered by his own cousin, you know, filled with javelins, and Darius took off his signet ring and declared Alexander his heir. It's a good story, right? Alexander made sure people heard it. You know, he was the legitimate heir. The king gave him the ring, right? Here's the ring. Later, he would also marry Darius's daughter, one of at least of Alexander's three wives. But he married one of the daughters to make it also sort of legitimate. He was the son-in-law, so it made sense that he was the heir. So by 330 BC, he's now conquered you know, all the way across what we'd call like Iraq. Bessus changes his name. He now calls himself Artaxerxes V. He claims to be great king, that is emperor. He claims he's the legitimate heir. It only takes Alexander less than a year to find, capture Artaxerxes V, have him tortured and put to death. Because Alexander said he didn't recognize him as being a king. He said he was just an assassin who had killed his rightful king. Then Alexander goes on. He fights through Afghanistan, Tajikistan. He fights all the way into India, gets all the way down to the Ganges River in India. And that's when that beloved horse, Bucephalus, died. In a battle, one of many battles fought against the Indian elephants, the Indian kings liked using war elephants. Bucephalus dies, and Alexander, we're told, was heartbroken at the loss of his horse that he had had since he was 13. And that, along with the fact his troops didn't really want to cross the Ganges River, and Alexander said, okay, he had enough territory, enough fighting, he was going to head back, and he wanted to go to Europe. He was going to go and take Europe, get rid of those Romans that were just starting out. Wanted to get rid of Saudi Arabia, or what we call Saudi Arabia. Then it was just Arabia. He had one little piece of territory, you can see in there. There's one little piece of territory he had missed because he'd gone around it. And so on the way back, he conquers Pakistan. And then one of those childhood friends, Hephaestion, one of his closest, probably his closest friend from childhood, one who had been with him under Aristotle, one who had led several armies on his own as Alexander was proceeding, one who had been the captain of the companions, the bodyguards, captain of the heavy cavalry, one who had married one of the other daughters of Darius, so makes them brother-in-laws. Right, that's how much he loved Hephaestion. And Alexander names him Chiliarch, meaning he's number two. When Alexander, not being like Darius, he already named his heir. Hephaestion's it. If I die, he's the man in charge. Then Hephaestion, at age 32, dies. Nobody knows how or why. He just suddenly falls ill and dies. A lot of people suspect, not poisoning in this case, a lot of people suspect something in the jungle, malaria, something like that. Now, in a very few months, he's lost his best friend, he's lost his horse, and Alexander returns to the capital, Babylon, prepares the army and sends him to go to Arabia. Starts the generals on war plans to conquer Rome and the rest of Europe. And then he suddenly dies, just 8 months after Hephaestion. Again, people don't know if he was poisoned, if he died of some illness he picked up in the jungles. You can name almost any way person dies, and people have guessed that's how Alexander died. But he had never appointed another heir. He couldn't bear the thought of appointing another heir after his best friend had died. And so he dies without an heir. One of his wives, Roxana, was pregnant when he died. And either Roxana ordered the other two wives killed, or one of the generals who, you know, wanted Roxana to be the heir, or her baby to be the heir, murders the other wives, make sure there's no other heirs. We've got one heir now. We got the baby who's not yet born. The new commander of the companions was a man named Perdiccas. And Perdiccas, who might have been the killer of the other two wives, comes up with a plan. Now remember what we read in Daniel. We'll try to keep this in touch. When he dies, the empire breaks into how many pieces? Four. You can read it in Daniel 8. You can read it in Daniel 7. You can read it in Daniel 11. Three different times in the prophecies, God said when he dies, it's going to become four empires. Not as strong. Well, Perdiccas wanted to figure out how to divide the empire. And his original idea was, okay, I'm going to divvy it up, and everybody gets to rule in the name of the unborn child. The unborn child is our king, our queen. And when the child's born, that's going to be our king or queen when he or she gets old enough to be king or queen. And so he gave, among the companions, he gave Antipater, Greece and Macedonia. And actually, Antipater was one of the few companions who actually didn't travel with Alexander. He was the one left in charge when Alexander left Greece and Macedonia. So Perdiccas just really said, okay, you keep the spot you've already got. Ptolemy, who had been a hero, he was the one who was actually assigned to go conquer Arabia. He was going to get Egypt. And Laomedon, another childhood friend, got Syria and Phoenicia. And Perdiccas named himself regent and got to rule Babylonia, Persia, and Turkey. You can sort of figure out, you know, who got the lion's share there. You know, he was the one figuring it all out. So he was going to be the regent. He was going to rule in the name of the baby until the baby, you know, 20-something years from now got to, you know, be old enough. Alexander also had a mentally retarded half-brother, Philip II. And he said, you know, we'll have the kingship split between the two of them. They can be joint kings because neither one could rule at this point on their own. And so Alexander's sister, Cleopatra, not the one who's famous from the movies, Cleopatra married, the full sister and a half-sister. The half-sister married her daughter to Philip II. I know that sounds gross. It is gross. Married her uncle, the half-wit. Perdiccas then betrothed himself to Antipater's daughter. Then he broke it off and married Cleopatra instead. He decided it was more advantageous to be married to Alexander's sister than to another general's daughter. Antipater didn't like that he broke off the engagement. He got a couple of other generals together, and they rebelled. They said, hey, we don't like Perdiccas. While Perdiccas is busy trying to put down the Greek revolt, Ptolemy down in Egypt steals Alexander's body. Why would you steal somebody's body? Got power over. I mean, he was a great hero, right? We're going to have him buried down here in Egypt. Right? We're going to put up a big mausoleum to Alexander down here in Egypt. So he diverts the body, comes down to Egypt. Now Perdiccas declares war on Ptolemy. He declares that to be an act of war, stealing the body of of Alexander the Great. And somebody kills Perdiccas, including a general called Seleucus, who would actually get to take over later. Now, why am I telling you this story? You might be asking yourself that question. Sometimes when we imagine, okay, Alexander died, it splits up and into four nice, neat kingdoms, and life goes on. It didn't actually happen that way. It did split. Did you count how many people got a piece of the original split? Four, right? And over the next 50 years, it usually stays four. It's a different four, almost every 5 to 10 years, somebody kills somebody else and somebody else takes over the empire. And sometimes the borders shift. But it's interesting, God said there'd be four, and there really stayed four. There was one brief time where there was five, and an even briefer time where there was six, until some of the other neighboring ones, you know, quickly put those under. But over the next 50 years, there's four different empires that just sort of change and meld around. Antipater declared himself to be regent of the empire. So Ptolemy's got Alexander's dead body. Antipater's got the child, now born, Alexander IV. He had a male son. And Philip, I got the third. It is Philip III. I had second earlier, I think. But it's Philip III. Second was his father. And Antipater thinks it would be a good idea if Alexander's mother watches out over the two children, the half-wit brother and the little baby, who's actually a couple years old at this point, actually. A year later, Antipater suddenly dies. And immediately, civil war breaks out. It's interesting, you know, every time one of these guys thinks he's finally figured out a way to, you know, to fight the system, he dies. You know, okay, now I'm in charge. Okay, you're dead. Cassander, Antipater's son, caught Alexander's mother and murdered her. And became also caught the baby and Roxana. And named himself regent of the empire. That's what everybody wanted to be. Antigonus took Babylon. Ptolemy, Cassander, Lysimachus had taken Turkey. And so Ptolemy and his allies distracted Antigonus, while Seleucus went around and captured Persia and Babylon. Antigonus flees, and in 310 BC, Cassander murders Alexander IV, now 13. For what simple reason? You can already probably guess. Power. And he's 13. He's getting close to time to be king. You know, people are already starting to talk about, you know, hey, Alexander, you know, should be king like his father. So they just simply murder him and murder the mother as well, Roxana. The cycle goes on. I'm not going to go through each of these things. The cycle goes on for quite a period of time. The various generals fighting it out among themselves, each one declaring himself. Now they started calling themselves king. They're no longer regents. They're no longer satraps. You know, they used to use those terms. Once Alexander IV is dead, they all start saying, I'm king. I point this out because if you did the reading from Maccabees, he says that each wore a diadem. Yes, they did. It took them 30 years before any of them had the courage to call it a diadem, a crown. But they eventually did. Ptolemy, in the meantime, he was actually the only one of the four, the original successors, the only one who managed to hold on to his territory and his title. And I got to this point last week as well. Ptolemy names his younger son to be his heir, not his older son. His older son flees to Seleucus, who's now ruling in Babylon. And Ptolemy dies peacefully, 282 BC. He's been ruler of his territory for 41 years. And the Jews did very well under Ptolemy I, as well as under his son. Seleucus continues his fight, trying to take over Turkey, eventually takes Turkey, except a general named Philetaerus manages to hold out one small piece of territory around the city of Pergamum. And once Seleucus pulls back his armies, he starts expanding his territory, and he captures basically Asia Minor, that western section of Turkey, and becomes the fourth empire at that point. Um, As soon as Seleucus gets home, he's murdered by Ptolemy's son, who had been his house guest. And at this point, the barbarians invade Greece, and the son of Ptolemy also dies. And so the first of the Antiochuses takes the throne. And then there on the second line there, 275 BC, 50 years after Alexander's dead, you finally got four different kingdoms stabilized. It's Ptolemy still, Seleucus with Antiochus the First on the throne in Babylon and Persia, Antigonus, who actually held several different kingdoms over the years. Now his son is holding Greece and Macedonia, and Philetaerus has the western portion of Asia Minor. I want to read, we read that passage already from Daniel 8. I want to read one other from Daniel chapter 11. Because Daniel 11 also talks about this period. Daniel 11 verse 2, it says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia. The fourth shall be far richer than all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these." Who's the great king he's talking about who would rise up? Alexander. And he's God. Remember, Daniel's writing this about 580s BC. 300 years plus, 350 years before the events, God says, will any of his children rule? God says, not among his posterity. Right? None of his relatives will get to rule. He'll get it. He'll get this great kingdom, and none of them will get to keep the kingdom. He says it won't even be able to keep the same borders. He says it won't keep the same period, the land. You know, everything he's going to accomplish will just sort of fall apart, and it'll be divided four ways to the four winds. Okay, so we'll continue that. Any comments, questions? We got, I guess, a minute or two here left. I know I went kind of hurriedly through that. I was thinking about making it two lessons. I thought, no, it'll put you guys to sleep if I make two lessons out of it. So I was just going to rush through it and try to cover the period. Now we're going to jump forward, sort of tell you what we're going to talk about next week. We're going to move forward, just like Maccabees did, to the time of the Maccabees, the time of that vile person. We'll talk about that a little bit next week, I think, is where I'm going to go. So, anyone got any comments, questions?
Question.
Yeah. Well, Israel always relied on Egypt, and I think it's mostly proximity. They're nearby. Whenever Egypt was willing to be an ally, Israel was glad to have an ally, somebody powerful. And it may even had to do with the time in captivity, their thoughts always going back. You know, things were good under Egypt. But yes, during some of their hard times, there's a war that comes between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, and a lot of Jews moved down to Egypt. Better than being in a war zone. You know, these two empires are going to fight for almost 200 years right over Jerusalem. So a lot of Jews moved down to Egypt because, you know, they had a quarter of Alexandria, and actually later the next Ptolemy will give them an entire island and city in the southern end of Egypt. So Egypt really liked having them there. Any other comments? Yeah.
Could you maybe comment a bit about sort of what was happening to the
Yeah, the Jews, because what we'll look at next week, the two kingdoms, the northern kingdom, the Seleucus kingdom, the Babylonia, and Egypt kept fighting back and forth. The Jews in Jerusalem sort of, a lot of them flee. They keep getting robbed because each army that comes through steals everything they can get a hold of. And they always keep raiding the temple, and the temple keeps losing, you know, whatever they donate to the temple ends up getting going away to soldiers who've, you know, robbed the temple. And we'll look at next week, we won't get to it this week, next week we'll talk about the fact that even the priesthood becomes sort of questionable during this period. And we'll talk about why that is when we talk next week. And that'll answer some questions from the New Testament as well. We'll bring in a few New Testament passages. Thank you.